From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. This week, we saw yet another grim milestone. More than 3,000 COVID-19 deaths in a single day Wednesday, with just under 3,000 more yesterday. That's nationwide. And among those who died of COVID-19 here in New Hampshire, Dick Hinch, New Hampshire Speaker of the House. We'll remember his life and look at what this sudden vacancy means for the upcoming session. Also, the ACLU of New Hampshire argues that more Granite State school districts should adopt trans student policies. These stories and more are up for discussion on today's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We thank you so much for being with us today. And we're going to start the show today with a conversation about COVID-19 in New Hampshire and the state's response to it. And then about halfway through the show, we're going to remember New Hampshire Speaker of the House, Dick Hinch. And we'd love to hear your memories of him. So call now. We'll get you in the queue. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. You can also email us either your memories of Dick Hinch or questions about the state's response to COVID-19. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. With me now are a few reporters who have been covering the COVID-19 pandemic. We've got Paula Tracy of indepthnh.org and NHPR's Jordan Haim. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
So let's get an update on the numbers, Paula, because a lot of people are wondering a really simple question. How bad is it right now?
Well, compared to the summer and earlier fall, things have really shot up. Dr. Benjamin Chan, the state's epidemiologist, announced yesterday 695 new cases. And back in August and September, it was common for 30 or 40 cases. There are now currently 6,303 active cases of COVID-19 overall. And sadly, yesterday, 14 new deaths. There were times in the fall and summer where we would have no deaths at all on a day, and, you know, one or two perhaps, and mostly in the southern part of the state. Last week, we saw a state average of 750 to 800 cases statewide a day. And sadly, the hospital situation is getting worse. Dr. Chan said there were 248 occupied hospital beds with COVID-19 patients. And that's more than double the beds occupied by COVID patients from October.
Wow. So the numbers are really scary. And, of course, worth mentioning that when we say there's a number of new cases, it's always known cases, right? Because there are cases out there, we can assume, that we just don't know about because some people are asymptomatic, but they still have it and they still might be contagious.
Correct.
Okay. Jordan Haim, I have a friend who describes herself as very sensitive to sensationalism. Was wondering about, you know, what we should make of the number of these cases, maybe even being small compared to the total population. So is that the right number to consider, the number of cases compared to any given city or town's population?
Well, I think the number of new cases that we're seeing every day is important, but it's also really important to consider the test positivity rate. That number is going to tell you more about how the virus is spreading and how community transmission may be increasing. So Dr. Chan announced yesterday that it's now at 9%. Last week it was just at 7%, and, you know, it's been much lower in the past. So
much lower, like around 1% or a fraction of a percent over the summer.
Yes. So that positivity rate that he was referencing, it now does include PCR tests and the new rapid antigen tests that are becoming more available across the state. So Dr. Chan did say yesterday that rising positivity rate is indicating growing community transmission of COVID across the state, and kind of warned that if people don't start following recommendations a little bit more closely, like mask wearing, social distancing, especially as the holidays are coming up, he is expecting those numbers to continue going up.
So 9% positivity rate announced by Dr. Chan yesterday, that seems like a scary high number, but I mean, it's also a statewide average, right? So, you know, different rates exist in different parts of the state. So what should we be concerned about in different parts of the state? Are some areas way higher in positivity than others?
Yeah, well, the positivity rate does vary by region, and the state actually does provide data on that that's very easily accessible through their COVID-19 dashboard available on their website. So you can see In places like Nashua and Manchester, the positivity rate is going to be higher. For example, if like Hillsborough County as of yesterday, the positivity rate across 7 days, the 7 day average test positivity rate was around 10%. Whereas in a more rural county like Cheshire County, it's kind of around 5%. So it does vary depending on where you are in New Hampshire.
Okay. Thank you for the breakdown of those numbers. DHHS Commissioner Lori Chibonette announced 14 new outbreaks yesterday. She also said they were closing out three outbreaks that they'd previously identified. Among those outbreaks was one at the New Hampshire State Prison for Men. Here's Chibonette speaking yesterday at the press conference about the particular risks faced by people living in congregant living settings and in long-term care facilities.
They don't have the liberty of socially distancing away from their caregivers. So if their caregivers are infected and asymptomatic, there is a high risk of exposure and spread there. Even with PPE and all of the things that we put in place in long-term care, nothing is 100% perfect all the time, right? So oftentimes you'll see, you know, kids that are in school have parents that work in nursing homes, and you have spouses of the people that work in nursing homes, and then you have families that come and visit, residents that go out to the hospital, new residents that come into the facility. There are all potentials there, right? And we never know exactly how it got into the building to begin with. The best place to stop COVID is at the front door. Once it gets in, it's next to impossible to track and to try to figure out how it's spreading, because it spreads so fast.
Lori Chibonette speaking yesterday at the state's briefing on COVID-19. Paula, what can you tell us about what we know about the outbreaks going on right now?
Well, we're seeing outbreaks everywhere, it seems, particularly in the most lethal spots, the long-term care facilities. We've got currently 30 outbreaks at residential places, including the New Hampshire State Prison for Men that you mentioned, but in Coos County, Milford, Windham, Manchester, Bedford. We do have, fortunately, 40 closed active outbreaks in the state, but we're seeing some pretty scary numbers at the Tilton Veterans Home, 168 cases and 27 deaths as of yesterday. I do note in speaking with my colleague Nancy West this morning that there are now 31 cases at the state prison for men in Concord. That's gone up dramatically from about 2 weeks ago. Then it was mostly in the psych unit. But now they've asked the National Guard to come in. Merrimack County House of Correction is also seeing an outbreak, and between the two facilities, there are more than 50 inmates that are infected.
And do we know anything about the ability of these various places to combat it? We've heard a lot about staffing levels not being what they should be, despite everybody's best efforts to staff up, of course. What do we know about their ability to cope with what's going on?
Well, in the nursing home at the Veterans Home in Tilton, the governor was making particular note that he was working with federal VA officials. They've got 17 folks from Washington that are infectious disease experts trying to help them there. And they've also put out a public request for the public to come in and help. And there are other efforts to try, but the problem is that everywhere in the nation, the situation is the same, and we're really coming up against a lack of people who are knowledgeable to help in these situations. Very scary.
Well, some of the most knowledgeable people out there might actually be listening to this program right now. And if you have insight into how long-term care facilities in New Hampshire are operating, maybe you have a loved one in one of these places right now, let us know what they're facing, what you're facing as a family member. We'd really love to hear your insight. Give us a call now. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. It's also a good time to ask questions, if you have them, about the state's policies regarding COVID-19. We're so happy to hear from you if you have a comment. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Paula Tracy, as you mentioned yesterday, the governor has been speaking about staffing being an issue not just in New Hampshire, but nationwide. Here's what he had to say yesterday at the press conference.
There's virtually nobody in this country as a medical provider, as a long-term care facility, who has extra staff just sitting around. Everybody is working double shifts right now. So the idea that we're just going to magically pull out clinical staff out of nowhere, we have folks coming in from across the country to assist. We have National Guard coming in. We have volunteer efforts coming in anywhere where we can possibly get staff, not just to that VA home, but to the other long-term care and congregate settings across the state.
Governor Sununu speaking yesterday at his weekly press briefing. Jordan Haim, what have you found with respect to staffing at places like long-term care facilities and hospitals?
I believe that Governor Sununu there was referring to the staffing situation at the veterans' home specifically. And as Paula mentioned, they've been bringing in some staff, some federal VA staff and some National Guard as well, but that doesn't seem to be enough. They are requesting help from the public continually as late as yesterday. And that's a concern at hospitals as well as long-term care facilities, seeing similar issues that staff maybe in long-term care facilities are having to deal with as well when it comes to being exposed to COVID-19 and having to quarantine, or sometimes it's also a lack of childcare options for staff. So that's where hospitals are seeing challenges there as well. And some hospitals have already begun looking to hire more staff to fill those gaps. Some hospitals have needed to increase their COVID-19 testing capacity as the demand for testing is still increasing. And then, of course, just hospital staff, as I mentioned, that have needed to step out for quarantine or who have themselves been exposed. So that is definitely an increasing concern as community transmission continues.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about ICU beds in a moment, Jordan Haim, but first I want to go to the phones and talk to Sheila in Jaffrey. Sheila, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to ask a little bit more about the situation at the state prison in Concord, because my understanding, I'm in regular contact with one of the inmates, and my understanding is that there's no, at least in the regular prison population, there's no effort to do social distancing or mask. There's no masks allowed. There's no effort to protect inmates at all, except that there's one thing that the one option, which is that they do allow them to have meals in their cells if they choose to. But there's been no visitors there since I think March or April. And none of the volunteer programs exist anymore.
Right. No. But you said no effort on behalf of the state to keep inmates safe.
My understanding is that there's no attempts to do social distancing at all. No allowing of wearing masks or no masks provided or anything like that.
Is there anything else that the state is doing? Are they not allowed?
Well, they're isolating the people who are tested positive. You know, they're isolating those people. So there's certain pods that are the people that have tested positive. But as far as I can hear, nothing else. I'd like to know if you know any more.
Sure. We'll put the question to our panelists. And please do stay on the line, Sheila. We appreciate your call. Paula Tracy, have you heard anything that is in line with what Sheila's asking?
Well, Nancy West is really the one who's been handling most of the corrections issues, and she may know better, but I do not believe that I have heard that information, but it would be something to look into, certainly. I should imagine that they could always go to isolation, but perhaps they can't do that with the inmate population.
I see. All right, and just before we move on, I want to check with you, Jordan. Jordan, have you heard anything with respect to Sheila's question?
I have not specifically been following this outbreak at the prison.
Okay. Well, Sheila, thanks again for your question. We really appreciate it. And listeners, if you have questions that our guests might be able to answer, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And if we don't know the answer to it, of course, we have journalists here at NHPR for a reason. We'll get on it and see if we can find an answer for you. Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Jordan Haim, getting back to the question of ICU beds, are people in New Hampshire sick with COVID-19 or anything else for that matter able to find ICU beds when they need them?
Well, currently there seem to be many ICU beds across the state open right now. And that's, you know, talking more of a statewide picture of what the ICU beds are looking like. But of course, every hospital is different, and every hospital has a different number of staffed ICU beds. And that's really the important thing to remember here, is that it's not just beds, it's a staffed bed. So for example, a hospital like the Elliott in Manchester, which is much larger, they have more staff, and they are able to, they have a much larger ICU unit than most other hospitals in the state, which are usually staffing less than 10 ICU beds on average. So for example, Lakes Region General Hospital, last week they were staffing an average of 6 ICU beds, and we're seeing also an average of 5 to 6 COVID patients in the ICU per day. So of course, that's a little bit alarming. But again, that's not the case at every hospital. There seems to be more of a concentration of patients in the southern tier, people sick with COVID, like we saw in the spring. But of course, that's beginning to change every day.
Yeah. And one of the things I heard, Jordan, correct me if I'm wrong, was that, you know, sometimes there are 2 beds to a room, but given COVID-19 and the way it can spread, some hospitals are just using one of those beds because they want to isolate that patient. Is that something you've heard?
That's not something I've heard specifically, but it definitely makes sense if you want to keep COVID patients separate in separate wings from other patients.
Mm-hmm. And what about aligning sort of the beds available to the patients who need them? When you say it's concentrated in certain areas, does that mean people in Manchester may have a harder time finding an ICU bed than, say, someone in Littleton?
A lot of hospitals do have, you know, internal flex plans, and you know, they're preparing for a surge if that is necessary, and a lot of them are able to transfer patients if need be. We heard Commissioner Chibinet at the press conference yesterday say that that is beginning to happen. Some hospitals in the southern tier in areas like Manchester and Nashua are beginning to shift patients around, you know, whether they be there for COVID or not, if their hospitals are seeing a surge. So it seems like that is beginning to happen right now.
Earlier this week, I spoke with Dr. Michael Calderwood, Associate Chief Quality Officer at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, an Associate Professor of Medicine at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine. His specialties include infectious disease and hospital epidemiology. And I wanted to ask him about whether he thought it was time for the governor to start imposing stricter lockdowns, similar to what we had in the spring when, for example, you weren't allowed to dine in restaurants. Here's what Dr. Calderwood had to say.
I think that we do need to move towards fewer in-person visits to bars and restaurants. These are important institutions in our communities, and so we need to find other ways to support restaurants, for instance, with takeout. Because once we come out of this, we don't want our communities decimated. We want to look at our main streets and still see things that are open.
So that's Dr. Michael Calderwood of Dartmouth. He also went on to say that there is significant harm caused to children when they don't get to go to school, and schools have showed a fairly low to basically zero rate of outbreaks and transmission of the virus. Paula Tracy, what, if anything, are we hearing from Governor Sununu about the likelihood of something like the safer at home order he issued in the spring?
Well, there's pretty much radio silence on that subject, Peter. The governor has not, and he has resisted any changes or rollbacks to the stay at home, the safer at home measures, because he basically believes that things are in place to provide an adequate, you know, capacity at the hospitals. And he has resisted other states' efforts to cut out down the bars, and he has been very concerned about the state's restaurant tourism industry that has been heavily impacted, and for merchants and businesses that provide the taxes in the state. So right now, he has not suggested that he's going to move like Massachusetts, which will be rolling back on Sunday, to a phased system there, but that always impacts New Hampshire when Massachusetts further restricts their mobility and things like that. I noticed, I was reading bit about Nashua has a number of casinos, mm-hmm. and there's been some discussion there about the city taking action. I don't know whether they will close them at 9:30 as this Massachusetts is doing, because they say it's just like the toothpaste out of the tube. It just pushes people from Massachusetts up to New Hampshire and then the virus. So right now, he doesn't seem to be entertaining any ideas for restrictions, but obviously that will change as he looks at the metrics.
Well, let's talk a little bit about vaccines, because a lot of people are looking forward to a day when vaccines are widespread and throughout not just New Hampshire, but the country. Jordan Haim, Governor Sununu says vaccines will be arriving in New Hampshire in a couple of days. How's the state preparing for the distribution of vaccines?
If the FDA approves the emergency use of this vaccine this week, people are expecting that to arrive in New Hampshire next week, and some providers have said they'll be able to start vaccinating their most vulnerable, you know, frontline healthcare workers, perhaps by the middle of the week. And we're expecting that first shipment to number a little over 12,000 next week. So right now, what hospitals are doing to prepare for that is just pretty much creating lists of people who are on the very front lines, you know, people who are working maybe with patients every day, people like physicians, nurses, to be able to get that vaccine once it comes in, and preparing to set up things like vaccination clinics, which will have to be done and set up very quickly because of just the timeline of this vaccine. They have a short period of time that this can be used before it expires. So that's what hospitals are preparing to do right now. A lot of them still don't know how much of the vaccine they're going to get. They've sent numbers to DHHS of, you know, this is how many of our frontline healthcare workers we want to get vaccinated first, but they still don't know exactly how many doses they're going to get next week. Long-term care facilities are expecting to get their first shipments the week of the 21st. So it does seem like the state is maybe focusing on frontline healthcare workers first, and then that's going to continue through long-term care throughout the week.
Well, NHPR's Jordan Haim, thank you very much for being on the program today. We really appreciate your insights.
Thank you.
And Paula Tracy of InDepthNH.org is going to hang on with us for a little bit longer. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to remember Dick Hinch, the Republican Speaker of the House who died this week at the age of 71 of COVID-19. What are your memories of him? How would you describe his leadership style? And what do you think should come next for the House of Representatives and for the legislature overall when it comes to both leadership and when it comes to handling COVID-19? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back.
Old Man Winter is at our doorsteps, and staying active in the coming months may pose a challenge. One solution? Become an NHPR sustainer today for a chance to win a Peloton bike, plus a one-year all-access membership to online classes, both live and on demand. But don't wait. We're picking the lucky winner this Saturday at noon, making your year-end tax-deductible gift as quick and easy at nhpr.org.
Right now, we're taking a look back at the week's news on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you so much for tuning in. And let's take a moment to remember Dick Hinch, Republican Speaker of the House, who died Wednesday at the age of 71. He was elected Speaker of the House just last week. And here he is speaking to lawmakers upon winning the speakership.
You know, I will always do my best to listen to you, to hear your concerns, and work with you to find practical solutions.
Now I want to bring into the conversation someone who knew him well, Senate President Chuck Morse. Welcome, Senator Morse, and my condolences on the death of someone you consider to be one of your good friends.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
We heard a bit of emotion in Dick Hinch's voice just a moment ago. What did being Speaker of the House mean to him?
Well, I think the reality of being Speaker was probably one of the greatest things that Dick ever wanted to accomplish. And when I talked to his wife about it yesterday, she said he got what he wanted. He wanted to be Speaker. And the you know, it meant a lot to him to be able to lead that body. And I think, you know, the challenges of leading that body have always been the same. You have to listen to a diverse group of people, and he certainly did a lot of listening. So.
And so how do you think he'll be remembered in his community?
Well, I think Dick's probably the, you know, real politician of honesty and integrity. You know, COVID, you know, is something that I think the public will be dealing with from trying to figure out how it, you know, plays in history for a lot of years from now. But I don't think that's what Dick will be noted for. I think Dick will be noted much more from his ability to educate the body and to bring them to consensus and to move forward. In the House, that's a totally different thing than the Senate. And you're dealing with 400 people. And believe it or not, even though we have parties, those 400 people certainly like to talk to each other about issues. And Dick was very good at listening and good at trying to get people together.
Do you think there will be one or two pieces of legislation that will really define his legacy in the House?
You know, he filed a couple of pieces of legislation, you know, that he wanted to move forward on to define his legacy. But, you know, I'm not a believer that anything like that ever works. What I do believe when you say legacy is, you know, Dick's a quiet man and very humble, and he governed like that. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, being there for seven terms and rising to speaker will be Dick's legacy. Mm-hmm. In the House, that's a challenge to first get into leadership and then rise to the speakership. You earned that, and Dick earned it, and I think he should be remembered for that.
What kind of issues was he hoping to tackle this year?
I think the main issue, you know, besides talking about things like budgets and things like that, which, you know, we'll all get into that as we get into January, but the main issue was basically trying to figure out how we could service the state of New Hampshire by getting legislators either back remotely like this or in the State House and the LOB to debate and to talk about the issues that are important to the people in the state of New Hampshire. He had been working with myself and the speaker and the Senate president since back in September, I believe, on the challenges of doing that. And, you know, when we got elected on Wednesday of last week, the first thing that we met about that night was to work on a couple of the RFPs that we had in front of us that we wanted to start to get things done at the State House so we could use some of that space. And the, you know, it was the start of what we believe needed to happen. And the,
using the space, you mean getting the physical space ready for people to meet in person? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, in the State House, there were definitely, you know, three rooms that we wanted to make sure that the air stayed clean in. And, we didn't have that challenge in the House chamber, but in the Senate chamber, room 100 and room 103, we definitely needed some equipment to do that. In the House, they had all the doubles in the House where they could host, you know, 20 people in. They were going to try to do the same thing. And the, those are the kind of things we were working on, along with Zoom and licenses and everything else, so that, you know, there was never an intention that the public would come into the building until, you know, we had COVID under control in New Hampshire. But we wanted to get the legislature back, and we wanted to make sure the staff was safe.
Mm-hmm. So what is the policy right now in your office regarding mask wearing? Are state senators required to wear masks in all spaces within the State House?
The way it works right now, and we sent that out again this week, is if you're in common areas, you have to wear a mask. If you're in your own office, you don't have to wear a mask.
Mm-hmm.
Along with that, I mean, facing the challenges of COVID coming in the State House, Now we've asked all employees to work from home, and anyone that wants to come in the state house needs to contact either the House or the Senate to get permission to come into the building.
I see. And is there any enforcement built into that? Or is there a way to say, hey, put your mask on or you're going to face X consequences?
No, I believe exactly what Governor Sununu talks about. I think common sense prevails, and I think you have to do that. I think the one challenge that I think we have in society is people have to realize they may not believe you need a mask, but it's the person that they're coming within contact with that wants them to have a mask on to protect themselves. So I think the governor's done a great job of leading on that. And I think society in most cases is working with the governor.
Mm-hmm. As you know, many Republican lawmakers have dismissed the importance of mask wearing and other public health measures on the coronavirus. Do you think the death of your colleague will change that attitude?
Well, I think that was an overstatement, to be honest with you. I mean,
which part?
I wear a mask when I believe it's appropriate. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of my colleagues do the same thing. So, I understand what the 6-foot rule is, and I understand what common space is. And I think, you know, whether you're Republican or independent or Democrat, I think you look at those challenges and, you know, how many people turn back to their car and grab their mask because they say, oh, I forgot. This is not something you're used to doing and you didn't grow up with this. So I think we're all working through this challenge and we're trying to protect each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly there are people who make good faith efforts to wear their mask and then forget it. I will raise my hand as being one of those people who has, oh, no, I forgot my mask. And then I go back to my car and get it. But there are some people who say, you know what, just not going to do it. I don't want to do it. It infringes on my freedom. That's their argument. Will those people, in your view, start to rethink that now that we've seen a very prominent person die of this?
Well, Dick was a good friend, and I think we certainly have the opportunity to remember him for exactly the reason you're talking about right now. And I think that's an important piece of, you know, 424 of us being in government and the governor and the council, you know, New Hampshire's pretty good at respecting each other. And I think right now, I think we should be honoring Dick. And I think we can do that.
Do you have concerns for your own health with community spread a huge problem right now?
Yeah, not because of the recent situation. I think my health is fine there. I've certainly tested when I thought it was appropriate. I think most people are like that. Today, I think if you have a cough or a sniffle or a sore throat, I think almost everybody first says, do I have COVID? And as they try to go about their life and, you know, deal with the fact that they want to see their family and, you know, things like that. So I think everybody has had concerns at one time or another, whether they, you know, have it, because it's not something they know much about until you get it. And so have I thought about it? Sure. Do I work to protect myself out there? Yes.
Mm-hmm. So what about going forward this new legislative session? Many Democrats are pushing for remote options. How do you see the next few months of legislative business being conducted? Will there be remote options for those who feel less than safe in coming in person?
Well, I can only speak for the Senate, but the reality of how the Senate will operate, you know, the month of December, which we're, you know, going to be reviewing budgets and we're going to be reviewing how the revenues are coming in. We're certainly operating remotely. The finance teams have already, you know, met with me to talk about that. And we have meetings set up next week on Wednesday and Thursday, and they're on Zoom. In the month of January, the 6th and 7th, as we speak, we're working through those two constitutional days. The 6th has not been decided how we're going to handle it yet. And the 7th is going to be on the State House stairs. As for committees coming back into the State House in January, I think that's going to be a challenge. Do I think we can work remotely? I think we're going to have to for the month of January. And again, I think it'll only be the financial teams in the Senate, because legislation is probably not coming out till mid-January. And we probably won't assign it to the chairs until the end of the month.
I see. So mostly remote is what I'm hearing from you, at least when it comes to the Senate through January.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Senator Chuck Moore, Senate President, thank you very much for sharing your insights today. And again, my condolences on the loss of your friend and colleague.
Well, I just want his family to know that we're thinking of him. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. If you've got questions about the week's news, you can always send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. I want to bring another voice into the conversation, Representative William Marsh, Republican representative. Thank you very much for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to join you today.
We're bringing you into the conversation because you have an alternate take on the death of Dick Hinch, or slightly alternate anyway. You were tweeting that fairly explicitly that members of the Republican caucus are responsible for Dick Hinch's death. Why would you say that?
Well, I think Senator Morrison and I agree on a great many things, and I think we actually agree on this issue in a great many ways. Let me give you a little bit of background here. I contacted the chief medical examiner's office yesterday morning and asked them to investigate Dick Hinch's untimely death on account of RSA 611B, 11I, and J. And specifically, I was concerned that I personally was called into an in-person meeting with Speaker Hinch last Friday. And during that time, he was wearing a mask, and I wore my N95 mask, as I'm accustomed to do, because I have concerns. My opinion as a physician was his passing looked an awful lot like COVID-19, and I had not been notified to take any precautions. So I contacted the chief medical examiner's office, and that afternoon I received the response, which was the public announcement.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you know exactly that those people are responsible and that he did not pick it up elsewhere?
Well, I don't want you to think that I'm accusing anyone of murder. No one will ever know where Dick Hinch caught COVID-19. I don't think genetic sequencing has yet reached that level that we will be able to specifically identify which specific person may have passed the virus on to the former speaker.
That said, you did narrow it down in your tweet by saying those in our caucus who refuse to take precautions are responsible for Dick Hinch's death. Certainly. Go ahead.
Yeah, we all know those. I've raised five children. And we all know, all of us who have raised children know that peer pressure is an incredibly powerful force. I mean, if your kids get involved with other children who are involved in drugs, who undergo risky sexual behaviors, who get involved in criminal activity, you know that your wonderful children can have horrible results. And peer pressure also occurs with adults. I believe that there is a group in the Republican Party and our Republican caucus who basically refuse to take reasonable precaution. The governor spoke about that yesterday, as I'm sure you're aware. And I didn't say masks. I said reasonable precautions. Reasonable precautions are not just masks. That includes hand washing. It includes social distancing. It includes effective masks, both for source control and self-protection, as recommended by the CDC. And it includes the ASHRAE recommendations for ventilation that we need, as Senator Moore said, to render the state house safe for occupants.
Representative Marsh, what has the response been from your caucus in response to your public comments?
Well, I turned off my social media feed because, frankly, I didn't care. Sometimes you just have to say what you believe so that you sleep well at night, and I slept very well last night.
Mm-hmm. Will that affect your ability to make deals and work with other lawmakers in this upcoming session?
I've been considered a bit of a maverick for years, so probably yes. But, we've had this before. It won't be the first time. we will move forward.
Mm-hmm. And so what's your hope for the upcoming session with respect to rules and guidelines for lawmakers as they proceed and try to proceed safely? What would you prefer to see?
Well, the first thing is we need a leadership team that is committed to two things. First of all, I think the voters made it very clear that they don't want a legislature that is absent for duty. There are a number of things that need to be addressed. I have a bill that I consider exceedingly high priority to reform the health officer laws in the state of New Hampshire, some of which were written in 1915. The health officers need better training. They need data sharing in order to be able to properly communicate with local officials and protect their communities. I've made this clear in a number of forums, and I'm currently sponsoring LSR 37, which is intended to take care of that. Mm-hmm. But what we need, first of all, is we need a leadership team that will commit itself to both reopening the state house in an effective way and doing it safely. Now, I don't entirely know what that's going to mean, because it could be remote, it could be changes to the physical plant, it could be all sorts of things. But we need a team that's absolutely committed to that and not committed to trying to bring people back as if this epidemic is not occurring, because frankly, that attempt is what killed my friend, Dick Hench.
Representative William Marsh, thank you very much for speaking with me. Really, really appreciate your insights.
Yep, thank you. Take care. Bye.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Still to come, the ACLU has issued a report that says school districts have more work to do when it comes to protecting trans students. We'll speak with the author of the report, and we want to hear from you. What's the policy for trans students in your school district? How has that policy or the absence of a policy impacted your life? Send us your questions or comments, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. A new report published by the ACLU of New Hampshire says, although the state has made progress in protecting the rights of trans people, individual school districts continue to be a sticking point when it comes to trans equality. For more on this report, we turn to its author, Polana Belkin of the ACLU of New Hampshire. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Peter. It's great to be here.
So this report discusses a few experiences that trans students have had in New Hampshire classrooms. I was wondering if you could tell us about one of those and what the experience of being trans in a New Hampshire school can be like for some.
Sure. You know, the one of the stories that I keep going back to that I uplift in this report is one of a student who, you know, while they were telling me this story, they were laughing and they were laughing about how at their previous high school that they would have to go to the bathroom at some point throughout the day, and they would hold it all day, and then they would run downtown to a burrito place with a gender neutral restroom and use it. And that was their way of using the restroom after a long day of school. This was like a high achieving student, and I cannot imagine what was going on in their head and their body as, you know, they were not able to use a restroom in their own school, which is pretty foundational to being able to go and learn with equal opportunity.
Yeah. And what about that laughing while telling a story that is not funny? Like, what does that mean to you?
I mean, you know, I am trans myself, and there are times when we have to tell ourselves stories with laughter, because it's so ridiculous that it's even going on. And I mean, maybe that's what it speaks to, is that it's actually really crazy that, you know, there's hundreds, or in this particular school, thousands of students that were able to go to the restroom whenever they needed to. And for this student, the single gender neutral restroom in the school was totally out of reach. It was in the nurse's office. It would take longer than the amount of time that they were allowed in most of their classes to use the restroom.
Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about trans students in New Hampshire, about how many students are in public schools in New Hampshire trans right now?
Yeah. So data is limited on it, but in the report, we were able to do to take a look at some other reports that have assessed how many trans students are, you know, out there. The largest study, which was done by the CDC in 2017, identified that likely about 1.8% of high school students nationwide identify as transgender. So last year, New Hampshire, we had about 55,000 high school students. So that would leave about 1,000 trans students just in the high schools. It's, you know, and then if that rate held true to most other grades, we have, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 trans students here. The student is no longer a hypothetical. Mm-hmm. But without a policy in place, those students are left to advocate for themselves.
Well, let's talk about these school policies, because, I mean, some folks have heard that New Hampshire has passed laws that ban discrimination on the basis of gender identity. That happened a few years ago. So when you talk about school policies, are you talking about policies that would complement this law, go farther than it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and just to speak to what you were saying, that there, New Hampshire has had a really long history of affirming LGB rights, so lesbian, gay, and bisexual rights. We don't really see any efforts to challenge those now, but trans non-discrimination is pretty new to the state. 2 years ago, we passed trans non-discrimination protections broadly. We extended those same protections to health coverage, to public schools even, but did not give them specific policies to adopt. However, the New Hampshire School Board Association introduced a policy back in 2015, which is JBAB, which is most of what the report that the ACLU wrote is covering. And that's something that deals with, you know, how do you handle name and pronouns, restroom use? How do you handle student privacy, which can be really big because, you know, sometimes someone might have a legal name which does not match their lived identity, but then that name is the thing that gets called out by, you know, a substitute teacher, or it's how your SAT is administered. And these policies give some guidance to teachers as to what to do, and then students as to what to expect too, because, you know, a lot of times people are looking at these policies, judging their safety even, like, can I come out here? Is this a safe school for me to be an openly trans or gender non-conforming person?
Mm-hmm. So just a quick check. You said JBAB?
JBAB.
What does that refer to?
Or JBAB.
JBAB.
Sorry, what?
What does that refer to?
It's very confusing, but there's rather than using numbers, a lot of school boards use kind of a letter-based numbering system. So J is student policies, BAB. I'm not sure exactly what it means.
Okay,
but that is how it's filed.
Okay, and so when you're talking about these, the content of these policies, are you saying it's better to be specific? For example, schools should define and then ban the practice of dead naming?
Yeah, I mean, the policy, it doesn't explicitly ban it, I guess, but it says that, you know, in all cases that they are willing to work with the student as far as their name to accommodate them in interscholastic athletics. Something really important to note, too, is not only did the School Board Association say that or create this model policy, but shortly prior to that, the New Hampshire Interscholastic Athletics Association introduced a policy. Saying, you know, that the right thing to do is to let trans students participate, you know, on the sports team of their gender identity.
I see. Okay. So who's doing it well in New Hampshire? What school districts would you single out as good examples of a district that has successfully implemented a policy that promotes trans equality?
Sure. I think, you know, I will uplift the largest school district who has adopted the most comprehensive policy, which is the Dover School District. And essentially what they did is they adopted the JBAB policy, but they also added a few other things. It's not like these policies that are suggested by the School Board Association are a one-size-fits-all thing, and they are meant to be modified. So Dover did a very nice carve-out in theirs, particularly around non-binary restroom use, saying that they may use a gendered restroom of their, a gendered restroom that is in alignment with their gender identity. Or if they're not comfortable, they can use a gender neutral restroom, but they will not be forced to use the gender neutral restroom, which is really important because, again, I think bathrooms are one of the things that this really comes down to. And it's a myth that's been debunked on the national level. There is no longer a coordinated national push on trying to ban trans restroom use. But this argument still hangs around in the municipalities that are looking at some of these. But yeah, Dover School District did a very good job with theirs. There's a few other districts that incorporate a kind of a gender support plan. I would say there's 10 of those. I couldn't name them off the top of my head right now. But that goes as far as to illustrate if a student is trans, who do they go to for help? Mm-hmm. Who are they, who do they initially tell about the transition? Who is helping them receive the accommodation in their, you know, naming or in their official record keeping? So that's a very helpful policy. Very briefly, sure. I could name the Gorham School District's policy, which was proposed by a student, and it's an 88-point set of fields that kind of work out step by step. This is how a student will be addressed in this particular type of record keeping. This is how the student will be accommodated for in these elements of accommodation throughout the school. And you know, it's not an explicit policy, but it really does draw out all of the ways in which, you know, trans students might be up against it, you know, as they navigate their education.
Well, let me put a call out to listeners who may have some insights on what it's like to be a trans student in New Hampshire schools. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Let us know if your school has a policy or doesn't. What should it look like? 1-800-892-6477. Polana Belkin, I wanted to ask you about policies when it comes to parents. Like, what happens when a trans student is not supported by their parents? What policies should schools put in place when a student and their parent do not agree on the student's gender identity?
I mean, that's a really difficult question. That's something that's not true just to trans students, but in any instance right. where a student may be receiving an accommodation that, you know, a parent is not necessarily hip to. In that setting, as written, the policy is open to interpretation, but I do know that there are several districts that did decide to do something as far as saying, you know, if you're in middle school or under, you must be working with the parent. And then there are some districts that say, you know, but if you're in high school, we can work with you. You know, we can work to let you use the restroom of your gender identity and use, you know, your name and your pronouns and whatnot. I know that there's a policy being proposed in Concord right now that specifically is dealing with that age limit and what to do with that. So, you know, this policy, it's been around for 5 years. And I think now that about a third of students are going to a district with this policy and the report is out, hopefully more school districts will start to adopt this, but also maybe play with it, make it better. And that's, mm-hmm. and that is a way that it could be made better is, you know, creating an explicit path forward and dealing with, you know, parents.
Polana Belkin, you write that Nashua is the largest school district with a trans and gender nonconforming policy, but it needs improvement. What is this policy in Nashua lacking?
Yeah, so the policy in Nashua that was adopted in November or December of last year in 2019, and that policy has the first two sections of the policy as directed, which is kind of like a general guidance on this is what the policy will hopefully do. It creates a few definitions, but then it only goes on to list an anti-harassment policy. So it doesn't create all of those carve-outs for name, pronouns, official records, privacy, all the athletic things, locker rooms, for example, is something else that would be covered in a lot of other policies. But this one is just the anti-harassment. But that's important because Nashua is a large school district. It's the second largest school district in the state. You know, and with that rate of 1.8% of students potentially being trans, there are certainly trans students in Nashua. And harassment is one of the biggest issues too, you know, just people not respecting a trans student's identity. So it's certainly important what they've done, and hopefully they will be comfortable enough soon to bring that policy the rest of the way there.
And so really quickly, you're writing that, you know, the 10 largest school districts without a trans student policy are Manchester, Concord, Bedford, Londonderry, Merrimack, Salem, Timberlane, Dairy Cooperative, Hudson, and Pinkerton Academy. So to adopt policies, that would require acts on behalf of each of those districts' school boards?
Yeah, because in New Hampshire, you know, there was legislation last year that actually dealt with student non-discrimination including gender identity. And that said that you know, schools should create a policy to deal with any areas in which a student may be discriminated against. But this policy is still filed as an optional policy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it would be up to each of those 10 districts to have that conversation within their community.
Helena Belkin. She's the author of the ACLU of New Hampshire's new report on bringing trans equality to school district policies. Helena, thank you very much for being on the program today.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Peter.
We'll put a link up to that report at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's show is produced by Jessica Hunt. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Senior producers Ellen Grimm and Christina Phillips produce the show, as does Exchange fellow Jane Vaughn. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.